What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in with the Producers Corner with Spud Too Tight. Man, I have a hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very prolific music producer, pianist, and keyboardist, and also he's a string arranger and composer. He's worked with the huge names in industry like Whitney Houston, Will Smith, and the Jacksons. Please put your hands together for Mr. Derek Nakamoto.
Hey. Glad to be here.
Oh, Derek, how's it going, man?
It's going good, bud.
Oh, man, appreciate you coming on the show and chopping up with me, man. It's such an honor having you on the show with your experience and background, man. And as a keyboardist, man, I definitely want to take my hat off to you.
Oh, man, my pleasure.
So, Derek, give us a little bit of a background of, you know, when you started, how you started, and, you know, what inspired you to become a pianist and a keyboardist?
I think I had the mom that wanted to play piano that didn't have a chance, so vicariously played through me.
Sure.
You know, they asked me when I was 6 years old if I wanted to play because they heard me tinkering on a toy piano trying to copy melodies off the TV.
Wow.
Put me into lessons and yeah, I was six, and that's pretty much how it started. And I never thought about it. It was just one of those things that kept going. When I was nine, I was in a Catholic school. The school needed an organist, and they knew I played piano, so the principal comes up and says, "Hey, we need an organist at church. You want to play?" My piano teacher also was an organist. So I asked him, said, "Sure, no problem switching over." Now, at that time, I didn't realize that most pianists did not play organ.
Yeah, you know, it's organ and piano to me is like, as a player, I just feel like, man, they're two different weapons. You know what I mean? They're two different styles of playing. You know, with the organ, you know, like the Hammond organ, we have the foot pedals involved, you know, with the lower bass octaves, and you have your two-section player. So it's like, man, it sounds really full, and it's like, you know, if you're not that coordinated, that may not be the right instrument to learn on. So yeah, man, I take my head off to organ.
This is a good thing for parents. You know, when any kid is that young, no generally is not part of the vocabulary. Somebody tells you to do it, you just do it, and that's what happens. So from age of nine, I was playing organ and piano.
Wow.
Did that all the way through high school, and that's pretty much where I made my money.
Now, are you self-taught, or are you taught as musician, schooled, or?
I had one private teacher all the way through high school, was a very accomplished organist in Honolulu and pianist. Then I took a couple of years of theory at the University of Hawaii and got out quickly because I was more interested in playing than I was sitting in an academic thing. So after that, it's all been private teacher.
Nice. You know, being a keyboardist, man, I mean, there's so many influences that kind of surround us and give us all that ear candy inspiration to become great. Man, who are your influences coming up?
Oh, when I was in high school, I think my pop or radio, let's say contemporary music sensibility, started really late. You know, when the Beatles came, which were huge, I was still buried in classical music. The first two records I owned were, remember, Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced?
Oh, yes.
And The Fifth Dimension.
Wow.
Left field, those were the first two.
Man. Jimi Hendrix is a huge inspiration for me. I play guitar also, man.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was Jimi Hendrix's title song, Machine Gun. Mind you, I'm 7 years old and listening to Machine Gun from Jimi Hendrix, man, and my music experience changed immediately. I mean, I just really kind of gravitated to the guitar and, you know, just tried to mimic Jimi, man, and just listening to it. And, you know, he played very complex stuff in a complex way, but if you listen to it note-wise, it was really basic. But it was just his style, the way he picked, the way he just really expressed himself on the guitar, man, was just really amazing. I mean, he still sticks with me, man. Yes.
Because that was the thing. I had never heard anything like it. And I was wondering, there was something about the way he sang and played the harmonics killed me. It was really intriguing. And with the Fifth Dimension, it was the vocal arrangement.
Wow.
I couldn't... It was a weird thing to have a black vocal group with arrangements that I heard on white records.
Yeah.
And then years later, I learned, you know, studying about them. Actually, from them themselves, I had the really pleasure. I played with them a couple of months ago.
Really?
Still killing.
Wow.
Marilyn McCoo is still killing.
Wow.
Same keys, same timbre.
Really?
The sweetest people on the planet.
And
amazing. They told me, you know, back in that, in the day, that was the unique thing about the group. You know, this combination of arrangers with this kind of a, you know, an R&B background thing, and the vocal arrangement, stellar.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Derek, I want to talk to you a little bit about the difference between playing in the studio and playing live. You definitely have experience on both ends, and I love asking other players and musicians and producers, is there a preference involved, or do you like a combination of both? Or
I love both.
Yeah.
But you're right, a very definite difference. And I think that's why for the longest time, a lot of very accomplished live players didn't work in a traditional studio environment.
Uh-huh.
And vice versa, guys working in the studio didn't necessarily translate over to live players.
Right.
Two different animals.
It is. It is, definitely.
Yeah, two different energies, two different the thinking process, you know, the approach. But I love the combination because that tension or that live element that, you know, where anything can happen on stage is what you sort of want to create in the studio.
Yeah, exactly.
And the discipline, though, that comes in the studio is really necessary. I think it makes players much better on stage because then you don't get too wrapped up in the emotional thing. You know, the grooves don't take off like going on the freeway.
Oh, totally. It's a more structured environment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You understand that, yeah, you can get excited, but feel and playing with the rhythm section is still key.
It is. You know, the 20 years that I've been playing now, man, I look at players coming up nowadays, and for me, you know, a lot of players 20 years ago and go back had more live experience before they had studio experience. And because technology's involved, nowadays you'll see more guys coming up in their home studios and then having no live studio experience. And, you know, I think a lot of times you'll definitely hear somebody who has live experience playing in the background versus somebody who's strictly in, you know, their basement or in their room just putting tracks together and laying it together. What is your approach where you kind of balance it on both ends? You know, do you have a format that you use for studio? Do you have a format you use for your live playing? Or?
I think in the studio, I always, if I'm writing or producing a vocalist, for a vocalist, I really would love to always have the vocal work with, even if it's scratch, it's not the end all, and to make sure I'm not just paying attention to everything being you know, quantized or you're perfect, because if you take a lot of classic records that you love and you pull out the vocals and you really listen to the track, if it was all tracked together, generally those, it's moving.
It is
moving all around, and maybe when you solo it and you listen to it on its own, it's kind of like, whoa, this thing is kind of floating. But as soon as you put that vocal in there, it's magic.
It is. You know, I talked about a couple of times in a couple of my sessions I had building production around the artist. And, you know, sometimes we get in a situation, especially in the industry, where, you know, songs are demanding and you're on a schedule. So we're not rushing the projects, but a lot of times I don't feel that we're really tailoring the production for that particular artist, giving them their own identity for a track.
Right.
What steps do you do to tailor your sound and your style around an artist where you're giving a Derek Nakamoto sound, that signature sonic sound that I talk about that people can identify, but keeping it different from the rest of them at the same time? What are your approaches for that?
I think as a session player or as a produce it, you really have to really step back and make sure you take the time before you hit the studio to understand the dynamic of the people you're going to be working with or working for. You can, even though the styles might be different, listening to the timbre of the vocalists, where their vocals are, where they're comfortable, and harmonically what works with them or works against them. You know, vocals that have a deep, a lower kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I try and make sure harmonically I'm going to approach a song around what they do. Or just be conscious. Sometimes there are things that they like, or you notice when you look at a body of work, there's certain things that just aren't there. And there are certain things that are there, and then I can go, yeah, different producers, but it seems like they like this thing.
So sure.
I just try and do as much research as I can on the comfort level of the artist.
Definitely. Now, you work with, man, so many people in the industry that are heavy hitters. I mean, like the Whitney Houstons, the Jacksons, Will Smith, Kenny Loggins. I mean, the list goes on and on. What do you look for in an artist, a new artist that's coming out? What are some of the things and key elements that kind of stand out in your ear, in your mind, where the potential is there to really become a next star? What do you look for?
I try and understand what is driving their passion for what they do. And everybody wants to be successful. You know, that's a given. But in the course of a conversation, I can tell if the most important thing to that artist is being successful. Or as opposed to an artist, you can tell the ones that are just, they have no explanation other than they're driven to do what they do.
Right.
And some of them are just, there's so much going on inside of them that the only way it comes out is either through their instrument or through their lyrics and their voice. And that's what I like. They can't explain it. They don't need to explain it.
Right.
I get it, but I can tell that they're just driven by the need to express themselves. And I work best with those kind of people, because then my job becomes helping them understand themselves by creating a very supportive environment, whether through a team of people or how the music is put together around them or for them.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that, you know, for me, I mean, that's the building process of the beginning of the song is always kind of like my favorite part of it.
Oh, man, it's everything.
You know, right, I mean, it's like, yeah, we're happy to get the song done, but it's that beginning stage, man, where that fire starts, where you just feel that energy burning, you know, and you can see the potential even before it's finished. You know, like I said, those beginning stages, especially with building that new relationship, that artist-producer relationship that I always preach about to everybody, it's important to have, not only with the artists, but also with the engineers and the other session musicians, if there are some present in the studio. Just having that rapport with everybody in the studio, I just think it's really essential these days.
Oh, critical.
Yeah, because relationships go a long way in the industry, you know what I mean? So, yeah, that's where it's at.
Definitely.
You know, Derek, with your experience, man, over the past years, you've positioned yourself to open up your own label, Nakamoto Music Group. Give us a little background of how that started and what's your mission on that one.
The reason is, you know, I feel that the music industry has been in a huge transitional period.
Yeah.
And, you know, none of us, even the guys who supposedly should, really have an answer of where it's going to end up as far as how to get music out there where artists can have a career. There are many different ways. And also what's going on now is that because technology is so vast and accessible to artists, everybody can pretty much do a record. But what happens, I see, with artists is that there's no guidance as to how to do a record. The function of the old school A&R departments, which I think were really valuable and produce, that's why they produce artists that have longevity. That's what's lacking right now.
Right.
Kind of artist direction. So what I did, and also for me through the years, I've been really lucky to have worked through a number of different very successful production camps, very successful studio musicians. And I know, and I've got a few really close relationships with a lot of people. We've all been tight through the years, who are very successful in what they do. And we're all operating independently. So what I can do for artists is looking at what they do. I have a pretty good Rolodex, best way to put it, where I can get the right people for what they want to do. That's what Nakamoto Music Group is. It's intended it to be a hybrid of what I thought the old paradigm used to be able to offer to artists. Finding the right musicians, right engineers that will bring this artist's dream or music to fruition.
Nice.
And it, you know, it's not one set entity. It could be a bunch of different things, all dependent on the artist. But I love, I call it like casting for a film. It's the same thing for music. There are many great guitar players, keyboardists, drummers, all the way down the list.
Yeah.
No question of good.
Right.
All the folks that I work with are really the best in their field. But it's the right one for this artist. And putting the artist's interest forward, you know, it's not my relationship and trying to get my buds in. Establishing a reputation where when an artist comes in, they know that whoever's sitting in what chair or doing what job is there because it's the right person for that, for their music. So
right.
That was the concept of putting this group together, to be able to offer that to independent artists that are trying to do things.
No, I mean, that's definitely a great idea. And, you know, having that success as an independent label with artists under you, I mean, that's just the goal of everybody. I think they should, you know, try to pursue to their best of their ability.
Yeah.
You know, with the dying sales of CD sales declining, you know, as we speak because of the downloads, what kind of recommendation would you recommend to, you know, artists that are out there, you know, kind of just releasing their CDs, kind of waiting for sales to come in? What other venues would you try to encourage them to take advantage of?
I think when, you know, back in the 90s, when I got into the industry, it was very song-driven. And everybody was trying to establish a sound, something unique. Then we kind of morphed into a period where it was more business-driven, and everybody just wanted to hit. And the only way an artist could make money was through the publishing. So consequently, and record companies, they didn't care. As long as they had four singles, three singles, they could care less what else were on the record.
Right.
So you have these CDs, you know, that are filled with three or four good songs, and the rest were marginal or throwaways. But the artist could make money, so they started writing their own thing. Most artists, we have very few, in my opinion, prolific artists out there who have 10 or 12 gems.
Sure.
My advice to, my feeling now is that it's turning back into a singles market. Kids out, or the audience out there, if they hear a good song, they're going to grab that. With iTunes and everything else out there, these kids are looking through the CDs, and they just pick the songs that they like, and they throw out the rest. So for artists, my feeling is, you know, if you're going to spend your hard-earned dollars and produce a CD, I think the traditional 10, 12-song CDs are dead.
Right. So
I'd say record the best songs you have, the stellar ones, the ones that you think define who you are as an artist, maybe 3 to 5, back to the EPs.
Yeah.
Small. And this does two things. It keeps the artist able to turn out product quickly, so it keeps, you know, we're in a very fast changing musical environment.
Oh yeah.
People forget very quickly. So this way, you know, artists can get your 3 or 4 songs out there, see if something hits, and work it. If something hits, you get out there and you promote it. If not, you still have resources to go back in and do 3 or 4 more. in a short amount of time, and it keeps your presence out there. And then if something hits, you know, you can package, you can bundle things together and do that. Let's say you establish an audience.
Yeah.
Then you can do your 10-song CD, because you have a fan base you can sell to at the clubs or at the gigs. But an artist really doesn't have to take the expense or the time to do the long project. It's a whole different area. You
know. It is.
Totally different time right now. That's my feeling.
No, point taken. I mean, I totally agree with that. And, you know, there's, you know, I never try to box myself in to have one way, the way, especially getting known and really making your name for yourself. You know, I tell everybody, man, you know, everyone's like, well, how did you make it? How did you get there? And, I always feel that I think it's a combination of everything you've done from start to finish that got you where you're at in your career currently. You know, if you're an A-list or a B-list or C-list, or I think it's a combination of everything together that, you know, makes you a star. But definitely with the CD singles releasing, I definitely would agree that, you know, releasing three hot songs versus 12 songs, mediocre songs, is definitely the way to go.
It's back to, you know, I always tell singers when I meet them who want to be writers, I'll ask them, what do you feel your biggest asset is? You know, are you a songwriter or a singer-songwriter? And some of them, if they're really honest with themselves, you know, they'll say, well, I'm a much better singer. Great. Good thing to define.
Yeah.
Now know that you're only going to be as good as the songs you sing.
True.
And if you're songwriting, not saying that you can't write a hit, but maybe either co-write with people, or if there's a song that grabs you, I ask them if they're open to outside material.
All right. No, I totally agree.
And some folks are just phenomenal writers, you know, and everybody's different. I like people to know that there are, at this stage, there are really no rules.
There isn't. Whatever keeps you employed.
Keeps you employed, yeah. You know, keep them true to themselves.
Right.
What's important. What is it you really want to do? Okay, great. If this is what you want to do, this is, you know, we'll figure out a way to make it happen.
Right.
But it's great. It's a good time for art. I think it's really a great time for artists.
It is. You know, with the ever-changing market, even on the business side of music, man, growing them into the DAWs versus the analog ways of studio recording, what's Derek Nakamoto doing these days in the studio? Are you on analog format, or are you on the DAW format now?
Nope, I'm on the DAW format.
Nice.
It's got to go where, and I know there are those, and I'll be in agreement, tape sounds pretty amazing. Vinyl sounds amazing. But that being said, between the cost and no one's going to A-B the two, you know, the music is really what counts.
True, yeah.
This day and age with digital audio workstations where you can recall things or work multiple things at a time, songwriters can write, put it away, pull it back immediately when they get inspired. It really, it's the way to go.
It is.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of arsenal are you running, man, with all the hits that you've created and the songs, man? What are you primarily using for your sounds and production?
Production, for me, I've always been a Logic guy. You know, I started with them using Logic when they were just evolving from Creator.
Yeah.
Which is strictly what for Atari. And they told me they were coming out with a Mac version, and I waited. When the Mac version came out, I bought it, and I've been with them ever since.
Oh, yeah, man. You hear me time and time again preaching on Logic Pro. I'm an avid user of Logic.
Yep. It's just a great... And I think there's a bunch of us that feel, again, apple and oranges, but when you put side-by-side, same gear, open up Pro Tools and Logic, same audio files, no EQ, no plugins or anything. Just listen to the output. They sound different.
They do.
And I always equate Pro Tools as sort of being like an SSL, sonically, and Logic being like a Neve.
Totally.
It's kind of warm, gray.
Oh, yeah.
Fuller. And and I really like it. A lot of my records are mixed by guys who use Pro Tools, you know, and they do a fantastic job.
Sure.
But occasionally, you know, I've had to, just by circumstance, we put out mixes on Logic, and God, man, they sound pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Logic is the way to go. I mean, I'm trying to get everybody to convert to Logic. You know, just because I feel that, you know, the current system that you may be on, if it's not Logic, you know, I feel that your creative idea is going to grow, so should your studio. And I feel that Logic is going to be that foundation building block that you can just build upon your studio, and just, it grows with you. You know, so again, hands off and hats off to Logic Pro.
It's just a phenomenal program.
It is. I can't, you know, agree with you more than that.
No, and you know, even for, I do a lot of orchestral things.
Yes.
I have to now, you know, a lot of either artists or directors are spoiled. They want to hear things virtually before they commit. And then in a quick, really flipping it around, sometimes we're doing last minute things for a session that's going to take place within a couple of hours. Traditionally, there's no time to send the music over to a music preparation company.
Yeah.
I know I don't have that window, and the last bunch of orchestral things I did for an artist in Japan, knowing that the time restraint, I just finish orchestration once it's approved, and I do all the printing within Logic. And
wow.
It's, yes, maybe not as sophisticated as Sibelius or Finale, but it's readable, it's a pleasure to read,
yes.
And it's, I can spin it really quick if I need to, and no complaints from the orchestra.
Lovely. You know, I know they made some new upgrades on Logic Pro 9 also, with the scoring editing system. I'm really anxious to get my hands on that.
Yeah, I gotta check that out.
Yeah.
Because I think they'll be the first to admit, too, you know, when you put them side by side with Sibelius and Finale, they got a little bit of work to do.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
For the fine-tuning and the, but still, regardless, to be, have an integrated MIDI printing, digital audio workstation, they really got it together.
They do.
It's phenomenal.
So what's next in store for Derek Nakamoto, man? What do you have on your plate? What's on the agenda?
Well, the thing I'm really proud of, or maybe I hate using the word proud, I think it's an honor to have worked on, was I produced an artist named Valdemar Bastos from Angola. And I met him 2 years ago. I produced a track for him on a CD for Shout Records called Africa for You Too, where they took 10 major African artists to do U2 covers as a tribute to U2 bringing awareness to the African situation.
Yeah.
So wow. I met Valdemar, and we did a song called Love is Blindness, and it floored me. His voice floored me, and we just got along great. And then Valdemar told me, you know, I'm going to do my record with you. And then he disappeared. You know, I didn't see him for about a year and a half. And then one day he showed up at my studio. He didn't have a phone number and address. He kind of remembered where it was. And he walked the streets until he found it. It was amazing.
Wow.
So we just spent a year working on this CD. He feels it's his life work. And carefully recorded everything. And just as we spoke about earlier, I built all the tracks around him. And the amazing part, you know, we had talked about a string section, and when the record was done, we had some very wonderful supporters in Angola that allowed me to go to London and put the London Symphony on it.
Wow.
That was awesome. And the London, they all were so freaked out when they heard his voice.
Amazing.
We discussed the possibility of him singing with the orchestra at their home base, the Barbican.
Really?
A performing arts center.
Wow.
So my work right now is, I'm finishing up the CD. It was mastered by Gavin Lurson, and killing Lurson mastering. He did a lot of T-Bones records.
Sure.
Old Brother Wore Out Now. Just great sounding record.
Wow.
The Robert Plant record he did, Allison Cross. So we got the mastering done, we're doing the artwork, and what I'm going to do is try and create awareness for this CD in this country. Although it's sung in Portuguese, it's so emotional anybody could get it.
Yeah. Wow.
That's what I'm working on now. That and trying to think of a way to present him in this country with a new lineup of musicians.
Yeah.
And then I'm also starting a new production team with an old, just a great friend of mine, Denny Fongheiser, who's absolutely brilliant drummer, producer in his own right.
Yeah.
And between the two of us, Denny is more on the rock end, starting out with a group years ago called Top Robin, that had, they were huge, Peter Kingsbury, in Europe.
Sure.
He did the records with a famous producer, Don Gaiman. Then he went on, he worked with David Kirschenbaum and was an integral part in Tracy Chapman's first record.
Wow.
At the hit Fast Cars.
Yeah.
And then after that, got it, Counting Crows, Heart.
Wow.
This project with John Paul Jones and Diamanda Galas. And he toured Europe and North America with them.
Yeah.
He's brilliant.
God, that's a diverse background, man.
Oh, man. So between the two of us now, we're working on artists.
Wow, yeah.
We have a couple of new artists that we're developing, and also writing a lot of music.
Nice.
Very organic acoustic with thin things in the back. So we're going to be making good use of Logic.
There you go.
Yep. You know, the realness of acoustic instruments against this electronic backdrop. And then as a duo, we're going to try and back up some of the artists that we're producing to get ourselves out there. It's kind of exciting. That part I'm really thrilled about.
Oh, definitely, man. That sounds like a killer combination.
Oh, yeah. And then you have to do it with your best friend.
Yeah.
How good is that?
It can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
Well, Derek, I do appreciate you coming on the show, man, and sitting down with me, man, sharing your experiences and knowledge, man. I truly appreciate it. You definitely have a spot here at the Producers Corner, man. I would love to have you back and talk about your new endeavors, what you're working on and things. So,
anytime. You know, I'm very easily accessible. I'm on all the places like everybody else, websites and Facebook, and I just love hearing from people.
Definitely.
I love hearing about what people are doing, and very happy to answer anybody's questions when I can. You know, I'm getting to that point. It's time to pass on anything I can share. You know, I'm down.
Oh yeah, definitely, man. Well, I'm like a sponge, man. I soak up all the information. So,
dude, you're doing it too.
Oh man, I'm trying.
No, my pleasure, though.
Well, Derek, I appreciate you coming by, man. Thank you again.
Okay, Spud.
You take it easy, man.
You too.
Thanks. Take care.